The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
So on today's podcast, it is my special honor and privilege to welcome back Mr. Barry Knapp of Ironsides Macroeconomics. Loyal listeners of this podcast will, of course, be very familiar with Barry's name. It is he who was my very first guest on the pilot episode way back in April. Back then, we were talking about yield curve inversions, just as we are today. But it was a different yield curve that was inverted back in April, specifically the 3-month to 10-year, whereas today we are talking about the more widely watched 2-year to 10-year. We open up with a discussion on the distinction between these two yield curves and why this one is a little bit more widely watched and a little bit of a more reliable indicator of what may transpire in the economy in the months and years ahead. However, it is important to note that, as you can imagine, all of the noise you are hearing about imminent recession in the US may be exactly that. Because as Barry points out, there is an important distinction between what is going on globally, which is led very much by trade, and domestically here in the US. I should note that Barry starts his discussion with some of the differences between the 3-year versus 10-year, I'm sorry, 3-month versus 10-year and 2-year versus 10-year. So here you go.
First of all, 2s/10s has more information than 3-month, 10-year, in as much as the 3-month bill rate is very much a function of the Fed policy rate. There's only so far that 3-month bill can deviate from where the policy rate is, whereas the 2-year note yield reflects where the market believes Fed policy will be over the course of the next 2 years.
Okay, so important distinction, yeah.
Yeah, it's far more of a market-based indicator. And I think that the 2s/10s curve is discounting a recession, but it's not a recession in the NBER-defined U.S. economy. It's a recession in global trade. Mm. And the important distinction, even from last April, was that, we've had these undercurrents to global trade. And keep in mind, global trade is an incredibly powerful force, in as much as economies number 2, 3, and 4 globally, that is China, Japan, and Germany, are quite dependent upon global trade. These are export-dependent economies, right? And all of those economies, one way or another, run current account surpluses, and those are our biggest holders of U.S. Treasuries.
Right.
So in April, my expectation, and I think the market's expectation, was that we had a sharp, almost collapse in global trade that happened late last year, beginning in November. Most people thought that there was a bit of a quirky trade element associated to that, in as much as, you'd had a very strong global trade numbers through the middle of last year into the beginning of the fall, in expectations that President Trump would initiate tariffs on China at the end of the year. When those tariffs were postponed, expectations were that you would have a rebound in global trade.
Right.
Well, concurrently with that, you had this huge stock market decline that caused almost a shock wealth effect late in the year that led to retail sales being quite negative. This was one of my Echoes of 87 thesis, right? That retail sales would slow for a quarter or so, and then they would reaccelerate. That all occurred, But in April, the expectations were that that meant that global trade would likely recover. And at the time, we also thought that it was probable that there was going to be a fairly comprehensive trade deal between U.S. and China.
That's right. That's right.
Well, here we are in August. We've seen numbers all the way through July, and there's been absolutely no rebound in global trade. The best way to think about China's impulse to the rest of the world is not their GDP number. If you had to pick a single number, I had to pick a single number, I would pick Chinese ordinary imports. Right? So this is Chinese demand for foreign product outside of some core commodities like iron ore and copper and the like, right? So this is how much demand China's drawing from the rest of the world. And that number is still falling at an 8% and change annualized rate. Now, just to provide some comparison to that, Chinese ordinary imports, as well as revenues and earnings on the Shanghai Composite, at the beginning of 2014 were increasing at a 10% annualized rate. When the Chinese heavy industry collapse struck through that time period, that number went to minus 25% by the beginning of 2016. That sent a huge negative impulse to the rest of the world, sent Brazil into their biggest recession in 50 years. So the fact that you've had no rebound whatsoever in Chinese, you know, demand of ore products from the rest of the world, that Germany is effectively in a something of an economic contraction, you know, Japan struggling, Korea even more so, right? Look at the Korean stock market this year. You effectively have global trade in a bit of a recession. Now, you might ask, well, how does that relate to the yield curve, the U.S. Treasury curve? Well, there's the very obvious dynamic that because they run those big trade surpluses, those are our biggest holders of Treasury securities. But I'll give you an even more succinct, germane example to this. In the early 2000s, as Japan struggled to come out of their twin bubbles bursting, they initiated the first modern QE program in 2001. They placed 30 trillion yen on bank balance sheets and hoped that the banks would lend it out.
Right.
By 2003, they'd become frustrated with the yen in particular and the fact that the yen was rising despite this monstrous increase in the monetary base. So from October of 2003 through March 16th of 2004, the Japanese intervened directly in the currency market to the tune of $340 billion they purchased. Now, at the time, ISM was on its way. U.S. ISM, U.S. economy was recovering from the tech bubble bursting and the jobless recovery. ISM had gone from 46 in the spring of 2003 on its way to 61 by the spring of 2004. Yet the U.S. Treasury market rallied from a 460 yield all the way down to a 360 yield by March.
Mm-hmm.
Payrolls had turned positive. The whole economy was soaring, but the Japanese bought 340 billion yen, and that money all wound up in the U.S. Treasury curve.
Yeah. Okay.
So when they stopped intervening, then Treasuries rallied 120 basis points in the course of about 5 weeks. Just a final point on that story was the Treasury curve continued to invert through that entire time period. As soon as the Fed started tightening, the Treasury curve went through what was called conundrum number one. It inverted all the way on twos, tens to like negative 18 basis points by the beginning of 2006. The event that caused it to disinvert was the Japanese finally drained that 30 trillion yen out of the banking system in early 2006. And within a three-week period, the U.S. curve reinverted or went back to its normal shape. So there's this huge, you know, so if you had to tie this to an economic event, there is a recession in global trade. It's dragging economies number two, three, and four with it. And that's creating this just ferocious demand for U.S. treasuries. But it definitely does not mean that the U.S. economy is headed for recession.
Okay. So then I guess that is, and that does answer my next question somewhat, which is you have economies two, three, and four contracting. Can the U.S. remain immune from that, the U.S. economy? Does it have enough domestic consumption, domestic growth, or other things here, or its own exports, I guess, that can kind of keep it above water and keep it from avoiding recession in the near to medium term?
So the answer is yes, and I'll give you a concrete example why. So I earlier described that 2014 to 2016 heavy industry hard landing in China. During that time period, those ordinary imports went from plus 10% to minus 25%. Revenues, earnings on the Shanghai Composite went from plus 10 to minus 20. Oil prices collapsed by 75%. Energy capital equipment investment was more than a third of the total at the time. That imploded. And if you look at broad different measures besides gross domestic product, which the expenditure method is probably my least favorite method of calculating total output in the U.S., but you look at gross domestic income, for example, it slowed from, call it, you know, 2.5-3% or above 3% actually down to about 1.5% or so during that time period. Gross output, which includes all intermediate trade, that slowed decidedly as well. So that was a very large shock, much bigger than China's export sector going into recession, because this is that was about what China buys. This is a little bit more about what China sells. That biggest shock did not drive us in recession. It did cause earnings to go negative, caused an earnings recession, but it didn't cause an economic contraction. So if we shrugged off that one, we're very likely to shrug off this one as well. And you know, we've already seen it in a something of a slowdown in revenue growth in the S&P 500 was 10% at mid last year. It's down to 4. So it's had an impact, but it's far from enough to send the U.S. into a classic economic recession.
But the 2014 and 2015, you know, slowdown, hard landing that you call it in China, that didn't drag down Japan or Europe, did it? And also, the economy was in a different stage of the cycle. The U.S., the Fed was cutting. No, the Fed was not cutting. They were staying at zero. But or maybe they were doing some QE. I forget exactly what point.
QE was done in the in the fall of 2013. So they were on hold. So you've got a much better monetary policy backdrop today. Germany was in the early stages of their recovery out of the sovereign debt crisis. So Germany was somewhat immune to it, although it clearly hit their export sector. Japan struggled with it. Korea struggled with it. And the emerging market world went into something of a recession. Yeah. Like I said, Brazil, their biggest recession in 50 years, right? So it was a big shock for the rest of the world. You know, and it had impact on U.S. corporate earnings in the U.S., but
that's right.
You know,
but this is bigger in terms of if you look at the total, you know, purchasing and economic activity in China, Germany, and Japan, right?
Well, remember all those countries run current account surpluses. They're all dependent upon exports. Their demand for products from the rest of the world is not all that great. You know, China's is becoming bigger and bigger. Their trade surpluses, or you know, current account surplus went from 10% in 2008 to, you know, effectively zero in the early period after that, and now it's 1 or 2%. So, but Germany still runs a 7% current account surplus. So, there's actually some good news that comes out of this. I mean, there are a couple of positive externalities for the U.S. One is that the lowering of rates is a boost to the housing market, and that will push, will permeate out through the system. It also lowers gasoline prices because demand for energy, China is one of the biggest, drawers of energy and oil in the world, right? So if that demand softens, that helps a bit. So there are some positive externalities to it. But those three economies, you know, going through a contraction and trying to protect their export sectors through aggressive monetary policy is just unlikely to put, you know, if you look at the other economies in the world, you know, go through the top 10 ranking, right? U.S. number one, and then number five is India. Okay, well, it's probably good. This is actually good news for India. You know, France, probably somewhat good news. You know, so I just think that what you're really seeing is all about global trade. One would hope that in Germany in particular, where they do have the policy flexibility to respond to this, that Germany would do what they did in the early 2000s, when at that time their labor market was uncompetitive when globalization was accelerating, and they restructured their labor market and capitalized on that. Now what Germany needs to do is cut their individual tax rates, cut their VAT tax rate, cut their corporate tax rate, and try and stimulate domestic demand, shrink those imbalances, and that would help the rest of Europe. So Germany going into contraction might actually force the political agenda in Germany and help Europe. Now, not immediately, obviously. I will say there's been some particularly bad news on China, and I'll explain on that. And the Chinese latest round of stimulus was some individual tax cuts and a administrative attempt to try and stimulate small and medium enterprises, right? Let's get the banking system to lend to smaller, medium-sized enterprises, the private sector, try and get some dynamism going that way. The lending numbers that came out this week showed the biggest decline of the year in the category that really is interbank lending. It's undisclosed bankers' acceptances in that total financing. But the issue with that is that they had a big bank failure, Baosheng Bank. It's a Mongolian-based bank. They have a couple of other banks that are in trouble, and it could very well be that you've had a real clogging of that credit channel with regional banks, which are the lenders to small and medium enterprises. The big banks don't lend to those small and medium enterprises. So, you could have a real setback there in China trying to stimulate that part of its economy. And obviously, retail sales are slow and industrial production is slow. And China is really struggling with rebalancing their economy, which is one of the reasons why I thought they would agree to a trade deal, because it's in their interest.
And they
right now, that doesn't seem. They may, but right now that doesn't seem so probable. So China's struggling mightily. Germany's struggling mightily. Japan just printed a pretty good GDP number. And Japan's defense, they've been uncompetitive vis-a-vis China for 15, 20 years. And so they've had to remake the economy somewhat. Korea's the one that's really not rebalancing quickly. But the long and the short of it is the inversion of the Treasury curve is telling you that there's a recession on the horizon, but that recession is a recession in global trade, not a classic U.S. economic recession.
The last yield curve inversions have, they did actually predict this. Not immediately, but within, 18 to 24 months or whatever it was.
Look, I mean, the one that I just referred to that occurred in the middle 2000s, that began in 2005.
Yeah.
And it actually disinverted in early 2006. And the real drivers of the inversion in that case was Japanese quantitative easing and then Japanese direct intervention into currency markets. The conundrum was created by external forces, and that's true now as well. So if we didn't react properly to it, by the way, what the Fed was doing at the time was they just kept driving the rate normalization as if it was the Titanic until they hit an iceberg. And that's what they did last year, too. It was the same thing. Sure. Like, let's just put it on autopilot. Well, they're off the autopilot now. I mean,
they
kind of learned the lesson.
Yeah, three hikes this time versus how many did Bernanke do? I mean, he went from, one to, there was a bunch. It was, every quarter for a couple of years, if memory serves, right?
It was every meeting for two years. Every meeting for 2 years. So we went from 1 to 5.25.
Yeah, right. So that's a massive shock to the system.
So this time we went from 0 to 2.5.
Yeah.
And they did it every quarter, so they did it more slowly, but they did the same thing. I mean, it's like the captain of the Titanic, just keep going until you hit the iceberg and then say, oops, we hit an iceberg,
Really interesting.
It's a version of the same thing. It's just that the forces have gotten more intense. And until those export-oriented economies are willing to cut their global manufacturing capacity and restructure their economies to focus on domestic demand, the problem won't be solved. Now, China's ostensibly taking steps to do that. Their current account surplus has shrunk a lot. But, it's a top-down authoritarian economy. you know, they think they can control everything, and clearly they can't, you know, but Germany has a chance to fix their problems fairly easily.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.